I think in the beginning, you know, I set out very limited measurements of what success is, right? So in the beginning, opening up is, are people going to show up? Okay. We set out to have this limited menu with very limited hours in a, you know, back of a building, shared space, you know, without the maybe the best street presence. And people showed up.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat. As always, I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at onmilwaukee.com. And I am joined, as always, by Lori Frederick, dining editor at onmilwaukee.com. How are you doing today, Lori?
I'm good. It's a busy Monday.
It's a cold Monday.
It's cold. You brought, yeah. You see, Matt, you went to Aruba. You brought back winter. It was beautiful.
How could I bring winter back from Aruba? It is summer in Aruba.
I don't know, but you came back and the weather went.
I tried to pack as much sun and as much 80 degree weather as I could in my suitcase, and unfortunately, it did not work out. Which, by the way, this is going to sound like a very blatantly obvious statement, but if you ever get a chance to go to Aruba, go to Aruba. I had a great time in Aruba. Really wonderful island.
No, I am very glad.
Very good food. Had ate well, drank well. Yeah. I found out about the Aruba beers, Balashi and Balashi Chill.
Nice.
Which are outstanding. Really good summer beers. Highly recommend. But we are not here to talk about my alcoholism. We're here to talk about food.
We are.
With a very special guest.
We are.
And the whole food industry, for that matter. Lori, do you want to introduce our wonderful esteemed guest?
Yeah. I'm realizing now that I think I know how to introduce you, but it's a little bit different. So we are here with Chef Aaron Patton, formerly of Iron Grape Barbecue, or always of Iron Grape Barbecue. But Iron Grate closed in November. So we're having Aaron here. Talk to us kind of about that adventure, new adventures, and everything that has come up in between.
So. In and out of the ins and outs of the food industry. Thank you so much for joining us, Aaron.
Hey guys, thanks again for having me.
Yeah.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. I just keep thinking back in my head that when you opened Iron Grey in 2016, like that was a very different, I mean, and you were working on it for a couple of years prior to that. But like this was, Milwaukee was a really different place. The barbecue landscape was really different. And I don't know. I think we had this conversation maybe early on, but what made you gravitate toward that in the first place? What was,
Well, originally I was designing a concept where I wanted to cook with fire, firewood, and have that kind of be the center focus of the menu. So upon the market research, you know, me being a Texas boy, I felt that not just doing like a hearth driven concept or wood fire grill concept would have been enough. So I settled on just going full fledged barbecue concept. And knowing that it was, you know, there were a couple of institution barbecue places here in Milwaukee that have been around for a long time. And I think maybe perhaps some smaller establishments kind of coming and going through the years. But outside of like maybe those couple of institutional places and your more corporate places, Dickies or Mission or whatever that was kind of coming in and out of the markets, that I had an opportunity to really set my own, you know, goals and parameters in designing this concept. And, and that's really kind of what the first step or question of success is like, all right, can I do this?
Right. Right. Yeah. And then your case, it could be entirely about what you can do, because what the market needed was virtually everything.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, because we had Ashley's and we had Speed Queen, and those had both been around for a long time.
It was not the same,
you know, but similar styles, you know, and maybe you had a couple people doing gas station barbecue. I don't know.
Yeah. Why is it that barbecue for so long in Milwaukee did feel like such an untapped well? That, you know, we had, like you said, Ashley's and Speed Queen and even Smoke Shack in the past decade or so, and obviously you guys, but why was it that it kind of that barbecue has never quite locked on here in Milwaukee?
Well, and this is interesting to me because we have people who grill all year. You know,
yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing. Like, we have tailgating. We have a tailgating culture. We are meat and cow and farm people. But for some odd reason, barbecue in Milwaukee has just, before Iron Grate, you know, there really wasn't much. There definitely wasn't much. That was an untapped well.
Compared to now, for sure. You know, I can't really speak to how other people prepare and cook their barbecue, because we know there's several ways to get there. Me and how I was raised as a cook, how I think about the type of work and at the level that I like to work at is always choosing what most would deem the more difficult route, the harder route to get there. And so, you know, we had our smokers designed, custom fabricated for me to be able to cook outside year round. And I don't think many people want to do that day in and day out.
That is probably true.
It kind of seems like owning a bakery. It's such a time commitment, and it's such a day in, day out ask that even if you do want to get into it, you probably burn out, pun not intended, pretty fast.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and for you, I mean, you don't wake up one day and say, oh, I'm going to go start a restaurant and smoke meats. So I alluded to the fact that you had worked on this for, you know, at least 2 years, but that it probably goes back even further.
Well, I was going to say, if you're from Texas, you probably have been owning it and living with it for a while.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, even when I was a chef in Chicago, I mean, we would do farm dinners, you know, out in the southern suburb farms. And for me, that's where a lot of the outdoor live fire cooking started to get honed for myself. And so it was in these kind of large group gatherings in, you know, beautiful outdoor organic settings, where I just got to, you know, smoke and roast and prepare meats and serve people, aside from the day-to-day job of working in the restaurants. And I think that's where I started to kind of say, okay, I think if I'm going to design my own style, I want to incorporate this as a whole, you know, around that concept. And so being able to, you know, design the menu around the whole pig and butchering and processing that in-house and into, you know, really taking the time and effort to how we cooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you find with barbecue in Milwaukee and with Iron Grate, did you find more or less freedom with barbecue as your kind of your aim? Because I imagine on some level it had to be a lot of freedom because, you know, like we talked about, untapped well here in Milwaukee, a lot of room to explore. But at the same time, barbecue is one of those things that people can be very defensive about what they think is the right barbecue and what they think are the right size.
Even people here who I don't know if they, I don't know if they know.
Like, it's this odd thing where I imagine, like, running a barbecue shop here in Milwaukee would be very freeing because it's like, well, there's not, you know, that there's room to plant roots and there's room to kind of explore. But also people can be so militant about what this is supposed to be like. What did you find?
I definitely found a a big mix, where I think while everyone's passionate about, you know, what it may be easier for them to put labels on things without maybe understanding what or why those labels are.
You're thinking in terms of style.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never try to put a lot of labels on our food, because at the end of the day, the goal is, does it taste good? Mm-hmm. And then.
Yes. The goal wasn't to be like the best Memphis barbecue, you know, or Texas or whatnot. The goal was to smoke items over live fire and get a product that you were happy with, that tasted great, that people wanted to eat it again and again. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Correct. So what I found, Matt, I think were a lot of people coming in and asking questions about our process. And those questions in turn were maybe a bit of a vetting process, but all of the vetting just need be done out in the parking lot. Take a look. Here we are.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So I think some people wanted to just feel like they got their own personal verifications made. But overall, from the beginning, I just said, let's make it taste good. Mm-hmm. And you know, how we get there is kind of a working backwards from, you know, we've got hundreds of pounds of meat that we need to prepare for. Mm-hmm. Fresh every day, and we have to have it ready by this time. And so it takes X amount of time, right? Working backwards. And so really trying to manipulate the capacity of smoker to the quantity of meat to the yield time of service. Those were really the factors in my head versus, the labeling of your different styles.
Yeah. Well, and I've known you for a while, and developing systems for how things should work has always been, I think, a strong suit on your side.
Yeah.
I mean, so when you go forward with a barbecue business, it's like, okay, how do we make this function so that we have the best product? Like, you know, that even the whole like moving backwards from like how much time do we need and everything. I'm not sure that's everybody's, you know, thought process. I'm sure that has to play in there somewhere, because you're like, okay, well, it takes me 8 hours to do this. I have to, you know, have it ready by 2 or 3 or whatever I'm going to open. But so much of what you created was also about, like, you know, I mean, okay, I don't know how to ask this question. but like creating a process for something that, I mean, because I would say barbecue is an art and a science, right? Like, there's a science piece to it, in the sense that, you know, you have to pay attention to temperature and know what you're doing. But then you have, you know, factors like weather and, you know, and I would imagine sometimes the meat itself, or the fuel, you know, has variables about it. And what you want to come out the other side, you know, the design of that food. There's definitely art there. But it's kind of naturally sets itself up for system. Man, like, am I wrong?
Oh, no, totally. I mean, I think for me and myself, I am definitely a systems and process oriented thinker. Because as we grew and as our, you know, employees count grew, you know, I became less hands-on with everything and more hands-on with some things. And so I would spend a lot of my time making sure that the staff had everything they needed to do their job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they would maybe things that they weren't asking for, but I could see and watch and sense, maybe here's some things that they need help in, not in doing their job for them, but setting themselves up for making their job easier in ways and more efficient in other ways, where maybe most people say, well, I mean, that's part of the job or that's how it goes. But for me, that's like in food is never perfect. The process is never perfect. Right. So I'm always pursuing to have more, consistent and never ending. Let's build that process and make it better every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you feel like that, like, I mean, I think you had pretty good success in terms of that. You know, not that you ever, I feel like that's an ongoing pursuit, that constant, you know, move toward wherever perfection is. And I feel like perfection moves, you know, the more, you know,
sure.
The, you know, well, the journey, I mean, doesn't really end.
Yeah. Adjusting process takes time and it takes a lot of effort in not just thinking about, man, how do I make this issue or problem easier or better for everybody? Because most people say, well, it's not broke, don't fix it. People are showing up, food's getting out on time. You know, there's no issue here. And it's like, yeah, that's all true, but in a process standpoint, everything can still be done better.
Yeah. What can we, you're all constantly looking at what can be better. Mm-hmm. In the process of creating Iron Great, I mean, you know, we talked about like style is not the thing, but you did introduce people to, you know, a different cut in terms of the Milwaukee rib was a different way of looking at how you could cook and consume, you know,
sure,
the belly portion of belly and rib.
Yeah, I think
portion.
What
was your motivation, I guess, behind that?
That was a starting backwards as well. Because if you look at, you know, a typical barbecue menu, they would essentially have all of the cuts or many cuts that you would yield off of butchering a whole pig. And so you can buy sausage, buy belly, buy shoulder, buy green hams separately as needed, and you know, cut, butcher, marinade, you know, everything you need to do for all those different aspects. And so when I was writing this menu, I'm like, I have a whole pig in front of me on this menu.
Right.
So from a sourcing standpoint, why not just buy the whole pig?
Oh.
And coming from a background where, you know, a whole animal butchery was part of my everyday in other restaurants, that was not something new for me or something that I was shy or afraid of doing. Part of the standards that I set for myself with my own business was teaming up with local producers and farmers and being able to support them. And you know, we helped some small farms scale up pretty quickly with, I think we were averaging just over 400 head of hogs a year from one farm.
Wow. Yeah, and that becomes a pretty that's a significant number of pigs for a small family.
You become in the bacon futures business, I used to tell people, like,
investing in the bacon futures. So that cut that eventually that you called the Milwaukee rib was a matter of, oh, look at this. This is what happens when we're pulling out, you know, when we're pulling the brisket off. And we're pulling the shoulder out. You know, we have choices here with.
Correct. And you've got two slabs on one animal. And so I looked at, okay, if I'm buying hogs for shoulder and sausage and ham, and ribs are the most popular thing. Now these perfect uniform, you know, 13 bone rectangle slabs that everyone's used to seeing is probably about 50% of the actual rib that's on the animal. And so by manipulating your butcher process and changing how you cut it, if instead of, let's say, one slab of ribs that has a raw weight, give or take, of 2 pounds, I could yield somewhere around, 18 pounds on one side of an animal of rib belly, bone in belly. Mm-hmm. So the overall rib belly portion of the animal was extensively more. And so my resale value of that portion of the animal went from 2 pounds to 18 pounds.
Right. And ostensibly, if meat is what you're after, you get a meatier, a meatier chunk of rib, you get, plenty of nice fat, that keeps it from drying out, lots of advantages. And you have an immediate marketing tool that says, come eat this thing that isn't like anything that you've maybe eaten before.
I mean, not that you're the first
person to ever cut the meat that way, because probably someone else has.
Correct.
But to maybe cut it in this way for the sake of barbecuing it, maybe,
It sounds, however it sounds now, fine. Selflessly, I set out to say, we'll put Milwaukee barbecue on the map, and we can achieve that by creating a cut. And most people think like St. Louis ribs is a style. Well, St. Louis ribs is just a cut of ribs. So I say, let's make Milwaukee rib its own cut. Mm-hmm. And if it's a little on the chunky side, well, hey, nothing's more Wisconsin than that, too.
Precisely. I mean, and my thinking right away was, people will be all about this because this is literally a big chunk of meat. It's not all like trying to draw things out from between bones and all of that.
Yes.
So from that angle, while it didn't, and it's interesting because I think while you did create that, and that became, I think, the thing that people talked about probably the most. I think it's also a small enough market that everybody's like, well, I can't do that because that's Aaron's thing. That's Iron Great's thing. So, I think it's hard to produce a Milwaukee style barbecue because, you did it. And now everybody's like, well, now I can do that. Like, what am I going to do? So, we moved into lots of Texas barbecue. Or that's how people have been. I think we have more Texas style or people aspiring to Texas style barbecue here than almost anything else right now, which is sort of funny.
Well, that's the most kind of standard isn't the right word, but that's like the most dictionary definition, barbecue. When you think barbecue, you think Texas style, generally speaking.
Yeah. So you did this. I mean, you did this for 6 years, and there's a lot more. I mean, obviously, folks who visited Iron Great, you put just as much work into your sides, as you did the meat portion. There definitely is still, you might be a systems guy, but the chef in you is alive. And thriving as well. So what kind of, there was a whole process. I mean, you're also a planner. So, one of the questions that people have had, I know that I've been asked a bazillion times is so why would, you had a successful business. You made it for 6 years. I mean, I remember we talked during the pandemic and there were moments when you were like, I didn't mean to create a pandemic, semi-pandemic proof business, but we did pretty well that way. So the biggest question, what went into your decision to close? To say, okay, Iron Great has had its day.
Try to give the clear, kind of a multifaceted, but I think in the beginning, I set out very limited measurements of what success is, right? Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, opening up is, are people going to show up? Okay. Mm-hmm. We set out to have this limited menu with very limited hours in a, back of a building, shared space, you know, without the maybe the best street presence. And people showed up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because you were in the back of Hawthorne Coffee, you know, and people could probably smell you before they saw you.
Yep. Precisely. So. And so that was, you know, that was one start, right? Like that was one notch of achieving, you know, what success looked like, you know, for me with this business. So, okay, people are showing up. Let's recalibrate or reassess what the next phase is. Expanding that level of business to a broader reach of catering and food truck. So I think the first maybe 3 months after we opened, I bought the first food truck, first of three that I bought through the years. Mm-hmm. That was just a empty bread truck. And we built that out and equipped that and hit the ground running the first spring and summer of 2017 or 16. And it was really just the demand was there, and it being me being new to it all. I mean, I took every opportunity I had where people were asking, can you bring your truck here? And I think most food truck owners, when they're new, are just happy to be thought of and considered. Mm-hmm. And, making a profit can be secondary because you're getting advertising, you're in front of people, you're being seen out. Most of these events, you're able to at least, cover your cost and then some. So they're never total losses, but it's a learning curve along the way, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so we achieved the next level of success, right? Kind of starting to do weddings and, corporate events, 4th of July pig roasts for people. And then we started to outgrow the shared space and said, okay, then we need a bigger kitchen. We need, kind of our own four walls. And lo and behold, the space two doors down was available.
Yeah. Yeah. And you really didn't know that. Like, that was not calculated.
It really wasn't. I saw them, the property owner for that space was white boxing because he was in between tenants and was going to have to reopen himself. And I drove past when I saw them painting one day and I said, what are you guys doing? He goes, we're going to reopen soon. And I could tell in his voice, he wasn't the happiest about that when he was explaining it. And I asked him, well, why don't you just rent this place to me? Yeah, I don't want to have to move very far.
Right.
I certainly didn't want to have to leave the neighborhood that.
And sure, really because you had folks there who knew who you were. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it was important for me to really stay in the neighborhood. And the fact that it was just a couple doors down made it that much easier. Mm-hmm. And so we had to, recalibrate and reassess that next level of going from a restaurant that was 3 days a week to full-time 5 days a week. And that was a whole nother feat from a sourcing capacity to cooking capacity to the staffing levels that we needed.
And probably
all while,
probably still at that time, how much sleep you were getting because you were probably still cooking most of the.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think when we were open 3 days a week, that was a very tolerable operation for me because even though it was a 3 day marathon of not really any sleep, I still had a full, 3 days in the week to rest and recover, and then a fourth to kind of get everything back in gear for the upcoming weekend. And so, you know, when people, I remember they asked, well, are you going to open more days? And I go, man, I work 3 days straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I put my 40 hours in by day 2.5. So I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The beauty of this is that it's only available for 3 days, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Scarcity builds demand. Yeah. So you did. They said, sure, come on over here. Yep.
So we did that. I think I signed the lease like a week after Easter. And maybe I think it was by that September, we were back open and the new space up and running. So yeah. It took a, you know, maybe three to four solid months of getting moved and, you know, everybody hired and trained and you know, getting that up and running. And, you know, with the new restaurant and the new size came, all right, we need bigger smokers. And so had to have new designs, new custom fabrication done. And that took time too. But all the while, these were all reinvestments back into the business, learning curves of scalability. Mm-hmm. And overall, like I say, we just kept reassessing what success looked like, because we were never exceeding demand, but just trying to keep up and meet it. Mm-hmm. And so we got, you know, comfortable in our 5 day a week digs. And then we get a call from the Milwaukee Bucks organization.
All right.
And they had expressed interest. And so, you know, here we have metrics of success that we never even set out to really do when I started the business, that, you know, opportunities come in front of you that you'll maybe take time to listen to and consider, but how many of those fully come to fruition, right? Mm-hmm. So if moving to a new location and expanding catering and corporate events and then getting approached by the Bucks were all things that actually happened, there's probably at least a dozen things that, you know, may have been started or considered that mm-hmm. never actually came to fruition.
Yeah, that could have in a different, yeah, mm-hmm. different circumstance. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we're operating at this level now where we're open 5 days a week. We have this corporate catering and weddings, and we have this partnership and wholesale operation with the Milwaukee Bucks. Well, I guess I should back up. With all that said, when most entrepreneurs go into business for themselves, a big reason for that is financial stability. Can you mm-hmm. create a job for yourself? It doesn't have to be the highest paying job. Can you start a business and give yourself a paycheck so that you can live? Mm-hmm. That's an accomplishment. But can you create a long-term goal for establishing your own retirement? Well, maybe that's important for some people and maybe not as important for others. And so these are all questions I would ask myself through the years. Can we do this? Can we do this? Can this happen? Mm-hmm. And you know, what well, does
and,
that
and,
take?
And maybe just to stand back, I think you see more of that happening and what you might consider more corporate restaurant, you know, in the hospitality industry, you know, I don't know. You don't hear a lot of people talking about how, you know, where their retirement is coming from, you know, because
it's going into next week's food purchases and
right,
next week's payroll.
Right. I mean, because the model for business in the restaurant industry has not typically supported like this, you know, successful entrepreneurial dream, you know, so mm-hmm. to think about that mm-hmm. is kind of a, you know, a step beyond, and to create that goal means that you're, I don't know, it's a shift, I think, from what you hear people talk about. I'm not saying no one else has ever done it. Mm-hmm. But with the way, you know, usually it's like, well, okay, I have a gig, you know, I'm going to move around to different restaurants, get different types of experience. Maybe I will always work for someone depending on, you know, how I feel. Maybe I'll go off and do my own thing. You know, maybe that thing becomes four things, you know, and yeah, I think maybe at some point you're like, oh, okay, how do I get out of being here and working every day and retiring? But it's, I think it usually looks very differently. I think you thought about this much earlier, on.
Yes. But, I mean, from the beginning, the ideas were, if you can accomplish these certain things, then take a harder look at. So we are surpassing every goal or dream that I could come up with and in establishing and creating this business. So you're overfilled with contentment and, you know, for that matter, joy, because this small little shop has become embraced by your local community far greater than you could ever hope for. Right.
Right.
And so that level, that measuring of where success is as we move it, so too does, as we move the business, so too does that level of what success looks like. And so really the final piece for me was real estate acquisition, buying the space that we were renting for business. And we could have continued on the way we were paying rent, you know, keeping the business alive and going. But what does that does a lot of great things for Iron Grade as a brand and Iron Grade as a business. But only did so much for Iron Grade and Aaron as the owner and you know, an employee of, right? And so, you know, the landlord and I tried many times to come to a deal. We couldn't agree on a final number. And I'll say I have nothing but respect for the man. I feel very fortunate to have had a commercial landlord treat me, the one that I had. It was great. If I needed things, it was always very understanding. And knowing that I myself could empathize his position, because I would be in that space down the road too, wanting to retire, wanting to cash out, wanting top dollar for my assets so that I could go kick my feet up and not have to worry about it anymore. So I had no issues with the fact that he and I could not come to a final agreement. But also that forces my hand on what my long-term trajectory is in running this business that we've chosen to do the hard way outside year round at night.
Right. Right. Yeah. So then you find yourself at this crossroads. It's like, okay, if that's not going to work, I mean, there's other choices, you know, but you have to decide like which one of these do I want?
Sure. I moved once, so didn't want to do that again. Moving the business.
And the space two doors down wasn't available. Which is, you know, you work your way down Howell. I mean, you know.
I will say it's not a light or an easy choice, but at the end of the day, I think one thing that the team and I were most fulfilled about was seeing and experiencing our last 2 weeks in business.
Yeah.
You say, you know, you want to go out on top. I'll use the analogy of, you know, a heavyweight boxer, right? They want to retire with the belt still around their waist, undefeated, unscathed for the most part. And that's you've accomplished everything you set out to do and then some. Mm-hmm. Be happy with that. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe some people would feel debted or more obligation to their staff and to the customers. But you are doing a disservice by feeling that obligation and not making decisions for the long run, maybe when they need to be made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because I think there is definitely a, and I don't know that it's completely unique to chefs, but folks in this profession are often, you know, they're connected to their concepts, but I've heard a lot of people say, you know, you create this concept, you hopefully it goes where you want it to go, but if it doesn't, you make a decision, you change, like, you know, you flip it out, you do something else, you know? And I think that flexibility is not super, you know, I don't know. I think that that going into things and just being like, okay, if this doesn't work for me the way that I want it to go, you know, we're just going to change our tune. That doesn't feel familiar in a lot of ways, you know, and to a lot of other industries. It's like, no, I mean, you're just supposed to work really hard until it works, right? Or something. Instead of like really seeing the signs and changing course. And I don't know necessarily how that fits in, but one of the things that has always surprised me is how folks can really like ditch a concept, you know, kind of like, okay, this is not working. And while there's always an emotional investment there, you know, ultimately people are also very real about, you know, hey, this is, you know, we're going to do this as long as it gives us joy or as long as it's successful, you know, or as long as it meets our needs, and then we're going to move on. I think there's a skill set there too, just being honest with yourself about when it's time.
Yeah. I mean, there's no real failure in anything that we ever did. And I think that's what
that's the shocking thing. Thank you for saying that. Like, I'm just like, how am I getting around to this?
But I think that's what I was trying to get at is like when you want to be done, mm-hmm. you are done with a line full of customers showing up, not two customers a day trickling in. Yeah. That would make the closing much more painful and slow to say, where is everybody? Why aren't they here?
Right.
Versus this is it. Come and get it. I think I was telling people if Father's Day was our busiest day of the year,
which it was, right?
Yeah, which it was. Yep. Every day of the last 2 weeks we were open, we were surpassing our Father's Day amount of business in half of the time with half of the staff.
Yeah. Wow. Like, and that feels good, right? Because, on the one hand, you're kind of like, where were you?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think, you know, so I want to clarify. I think some people look at that as maybe what they would call a cash grab or a closing honeymoon, so to speak. Yeah. And it's funny because the economics will always fall into place, especially in the restaurant industry. Had I told the staff during those last 2 weeks of being that busy, we're not going to sell out, we're not going to close early, we're going to push through, that would have been a selfish cash grab.
Right.
But with the amount of staff we had and the amount of people that were showing up, knowing we had to go to bed and do it all again the next day, we were not going to kill ourselves that way. It's not worth it. Right. And so.
Well, and on the other hand too, like people get very sad, sometimes upset, you know, when they can't say farewell to, you know, like when a place just closes and it's like, oh my God, mm-hmm. I didn't know that. I never got to have my last meal there. And I've always thought it was, you know, like for as many people as like, oh, they're just trying to get all the money they can out of you before they go out, you know, or whatever. It's like, there's also a courtesy piece there where it's like, come back, you know, say goodbye, you know, because food is an emotional, I don't know, there's emotional attachments. And sometimes just an intellectual attachment, you know, to that place.
Can I ask, what was the restaurant that you always wanted to visit one more time, but they closed?
Oh.
Me or Lori?
Oh.
Both of you.
I would have loved to have seen Thomas Hawk one more time at circa 1880 before he closed.
Yeah. I did go. I did have that chance. I didn't go the last night they were open, but I actually had tickets to a dinner that ended up poised like, I don't know, a week and a half probably before they closed. And that was, but I did feel very much like when he closed down Karl Rausch, which from my perspective, he had done a fairly tremendous job of resurrecting without changing the concept. Now we can all argue all day, should he have changed the concept? I mean, he will ponder that for the rest of his life, but you know, that he had done a good job with it and it just didn't resonate with the core of people that he actually had going there. And that place, I wasn't able, like I did not get to say farewell to something that not only he had recreated or brought back, but something that had been around that I just hadn't paid a lot of attention to. Because it wasn't my, you know, I mean, it was that place you took for granted. So, anyway.
Sorry, all that. The idea of like not being able to say goodbye to a place, I wanted it sounded interesting.
Do you have that, Matt? Or no?
Not hugely. Okay. Because I miss out on everything. So, like, I miss everything's closings and openings. It would have been cool. I would have liked to have gotten over to Wolf Peach one more time before that shut down. But yeah, it's like childhood places, you know, like I believe Furch's is closed in Greendale and that was like a classic family place to go. And Now it doesn't exist, and you're just like, well, I wish I had gone that one more time. I wish I had made the time that one day just to have one more, you know, proper scoop. Yeah. But yeah.
So people did get that. So, I mean, that is to me, at least, a kindness. But I think you and I, Aaron, talked about this, that you get a mix of people. You know, you get the people who really did come and say, you know, who come to say their farewells, to say, hey, Aaron, thanks, to get that last bite of food. I knew at least two people who came and bought food and then tucked some away in the freezer so that they could delay that. That doesn't work so well. I just had a report from someone who's like, you know, I put away some of my barbecue from Iron Grate. And I pulled it out the other day and it's just not the same. Right. And I'm just like, well, that's the beauty of barbecue. But anyway, but you kind of, and then you had a mix of people, like people who came the first time. And that's always weird to me, like, for someone to go to a restaurant for the very first time as they're sort of saying goodbye.
The first couple of days of, are after announcing closing, we were starting to get a gauge that, okay, selling out every day, maybe this is how these last 2 weeks are going to go. The staff had to talk me out of making posts saying, look, if you haven't been here before, just please don't come. That our last 2 weeks really were meant to be for those people that have come, that wanted their last meal, that wanted to say goodbye. And, you know, and nothing against honestly, anybody that was a new customer trying us out for the first time that last 2 weeks, but it was just an interesting dynamic of them asking, well, why? And speculating. And it's, don't know you.
Right.
Who are you? But to everyone else that came and wished us well, the last 2 weeks was in everything that we did, start to finish, of Iron Great, the last 2 weeks solidified for myself, and I'll go ahead and speak for the team, just validated for us the work that we put in. I did not anticipate the quantity of people sharing their tears, wishing us well. The amount of people's weddings, birthdays. I can't tell you how many times a customer would come and say, you know, my mom just came home from the hospital and Iron Great's the meal she wants to make her feel better. Or wife just had a baby and wants Iron Great now. We became a place that was comforting for people, and more than anything monetarily, that's what you set out to do. So when you get a chance to actually sit down with that for a minute and recognize the impact that you have, that we had with people, wow, it really was so much more than just a restaurant. And I think because that was in the sights of it all in the beginning, that's really what transpired to the end.
Yeah. Well, and it's almost a little sad, because all of those things don't generally come out, you know, until people really think. I mean, I don't even think people know how much a space means to them until they come to that fork where, I might not have this anymore. Like, holy cow. Like, you know, well, you catered like my wedding. You did this, like,
celebrity. Famous people will never know how beloved they are.
Yeah.
Because all the, you know, the kind well wishes come after, you know, they pass away. It's like a lot of people are like, we should write pre-obituaries, like give people their flowers before they die. Yeah. So instead of everyone like being like, oh man, Bill Paxton, you didn't realize how great he was. Well, he didn't, and after he died, like he passed away, and all of a sudden everyone was like, you know who was a really good actor? Bill Paxton. Yeah. Well, it would have been nice if we had the time to tell him that.
But but that's another thing too, to be said for going out while you're hot. You know, while the coals are still burning, is, you know, because ultimately, you know, and not that you close to hear people tell you that, but you do probably have a better chance of having people say, hey, you know, you were a significant part of our lives, and I'm, you know, thank you. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm very happy for that experience and that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, the relationships that have come from this will last a lifetime, but the amount of relationships that have come from it is a lifetime's worth.
Yeah.
So there's nothing but gratitude there.
Yeah. It's sort of astounding. I'm not surprised, but but probably, you know, like your emotions don't necessarily become part of, like, that's not part of your business plan, right? That probably wasn't part of your measurement of success. Maybe it was, you know, obviously giving people a good experience is part of, you know, what your goals are. But did you, would you have expected it? Or was it? And I'm not saying you should be really surprised because, you know, you ran this crappy barbecue business and then all these people miss you. You know, and I'm not putting it that way at all. Like when you run a good business, you do probably have some anticipation that people will be, you know, will come out to support you. But did you count on it being in the volume or the to the extent that it was? Is maybe how unexpected were the responses?
I think I'll explain it like this. You know, and this may shift topics a bit, but I've been in the restaurant industry for 21 years now, and I've seen it all. And we have, as a society, have seen a huge shift in the restaurant industry as a whole, how people are treated, what the expectations are for employers and management. You know, I was growing up as a young cook and a young chef, was probably on the tail end of what would make most HR departments cringe. And most lawyers glee, because how I came up in this industry was very difficult on an expectation level and in an execution level. And I measure my success from that. That was mostly driven by spite, saying I will not be beaten. I will be, when I leave this kitchen at this particular job I'm at, I will leave the best. I will be the most skilled, most knowledgeable, and I will be happy with that. And so when it's my turn now to open a restaurant and have my staff, I said, okay, I'm not going to be the chef or manager that I maybe came up with. And so I'm going to change how I treat staff. I'm going to change how I talk to them versus how I was talked to. And I think at one point here towards the end, I realized that while I had made that environment different, the level of work and the amount of, let's just say, not just skill, but what it takes from you, I was still guilty of perpetuating.
Mm-hmm. Doing everything.
So maybe
you've said it many times. We do this the hard way, right?
Very much.
The work ethic. The hardcore work ethic that says if this is not hard, it can't possibly be good on the other side.
Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what I would pride ourselves on, that while everyone is at home asleep and it's 0 degrees outside, like we're hard at work, and that's what separated us. And I think, you know, I started to see in a good way with the team and the staff that their level of normal and capabilities and skills improved tremendously. They were doing things I don't think they ever thought that they were possible to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you push people out of their comfort zone and they can grow. But what I saw that I was not happy with was the difficult level of how we operated. That was a lot. That was a lot for the staff too. And while they showed up every day and worked hard and for the most part, like never really complained about it, I saw what I had created and it was too much. And I think while everyone appreciates the end result of that, the cost from us was too much to keep going. And that, again, I will speak for my team as a whole on that. Mm-hmm. So while I think a lot of people were sad and would like to see us continue, I don't think any of us could have continued for very much longer operating at that level.
Yeah.
And be happy about it.
Yeah. So, yeah. So about like, yeah, it's the right time, you know,
mm-hmm.
do something, you know, you can only work that hard for so long. Yeah. Work people that hard for that long or somebody burns right. out, you know. And maybe we have a new consciousness of what, you know, mental health and, you know, how far we can go without, you know, sleep or a pass.
Correct.
I yep. mean, this industry has been really hard on people for a very long time. Yeah. But that's fair. That's fair. And I guess you've taken things out of this too. You know, people have always, I think you've always been pretty straight with folks. You know, we talk about good reviews, bad reviews, you know. You were one of the first people, I think, to say that, one of the first people to really have a conversation with me about the notion that, you know, we've been operating under the, assumption that the customer is always right. You know, hospitality has been forced to do that, you know, for a long time. That was the saying, you know, customer is always right. Customer is always right. You know, we're here to make your life better. And you were always really straight about that. You're like, that's not always true. and that's one of the things too. Like, what do customers need to know? I mean, I think not having a restaurant at this point in your life, you know, if you could tell people something that if they listen, you know, it enhance their understanding of what to expect from, you know, hospitality.
Sure.
I mean, what do people need to know about walking into a scenario and thinking like, well, you're supposed to just give me whatever I want, right? Like,
well, I think a lot of people think that there is this, you know, Wizard of Oz machine behind the curtain that takes care of everything they don't see.
Yeah.
When in fact it really is, for most restaurants, like mom and pop shops, family run, real people doing everything. And so there's not some, for most places, some, you know, mystery corporate office in another state, you know, fielding and responding to all the things, that there's real people behind it. I think it's interesting that, and, you know, there are people who operate their businesses and make decisions on a whim, but, you know, there's a lot of thought that goes into the whys of a place doing the things that they do. So I think for most people, airing your grievance is welcomed because you're paying. And if something did not, isn't what you envisioned it to be, airing that grievance is totally fine. Mm-hmm. Airing that grievance directly is the what is recommended.
Much preferred.
However, right. Yes, an opinion doesn't mean you're right. So if somebody came to me and said, your greens were too sweet, okay, mm-hmm. that's an opinion. Mm-hmm. If the question was, why are your greens the way they are? Mm-hmm. Now we're opening a dialogue for discussion for you to understand why we do the things the way we do. Mm-hmm. So I mostly did not listen to opinions or care mm-hmm. for opinions. But if something was a mistake. Something was overcooked, undercooked, too salty. We dropped the ball somewhere. That's beyond opinion. And I'm more than happy to address that.
Right.
But I don't have time.
Because that's your job, right? Your job isn't to be everything to everyone, but it is to do the job that you're doing well. Is kind of what I'm hearing on there. Yeah.
And so if that, and it did at times have a view to the public that, well, this owner doesn't take criticism. Well, who's critiquing me? Because while I respect criticism, I don't respect opinions.
Because ultimately, I mean, like, you're creating the food as you envision them. People have choices to eat there or not eat there. If your opinion is like, oh, I don't like those greens, you have a choice to not order. You know, Iron Great did not have to plead the case for being everybody's favorite spot for greens, right?
You came, you tried, you didn't like, move on. That's it. You know, I don't get to go back to the hardware store and say half of these nails bent when I hit them with my hammer. I want a new box.
Right. Well, yeah. And I mean, it's different if I come in and, you know, you give me, I don't know, there's a fly in my green, to use there's a fly in my soup reference. Like, okay.
It would have been a grasshopper in the greens and it would have gotten washed.
Yeah. That's what I would have said. Right. So, but you know, that's a different scenario, you know, not liking something, like, you have choices. Yeah. Move along. If it's a criticism of like things done right or not done right. I just feel like people often, you know, people don't get a chance to talk about those things and the things that they learned in dealing with customers along the way. Ultimately, the question is, like, I don't know, would you do it all over again? And I don't mean the same way, you know, in every.
Absolutely. I wouldn't, even to this day, I don't think there's anything I would have changed or done differently or not have done. I'm in the most content I feel one could be in this journey and experience. I think the fulfillment came from the relationships, the interactions, the getting to experience what we did for people and not just feeding them and sending them on their way. And ultimately, right, I think that's why most people are in the restaurant industry. They enjoy hosting. They enjoy providing great service. And they enjoy knowing that people have been satiated on many levels. And, you know, being a part of those memories. I mean, how many, you know, family Christmas meals at this restaurant or employee party at this place. The amount of memories that Iron Great created for people, we will always be a part of, and there's nothing more. There's nothing more you could want.
Well, that's awesome. And you've landed pretty well, I would say, for a barbecue guy. Do you want to say anything like about what you're doing now? That's the other question, probably. I know other people ask me, where'd Aaron go? Where's he gonna, you know?
I suppose I should. I mean, news is coming out soon.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Scoopy.
So I am not cooking anymore.
not directly
for the public, anyway, right? I took a new position with a newer company that's a Wisconsin-based company. They are called Smoky Woods Barbecue. Mm-hmm. And Smoky Woods Barbecue is a manufacturer of barbecue cooking fuels. So wood, chip, chunks, pellet, firewood sticks. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what I do is the marketing for these products. So aside from just photos and things, but recipes and recipe development, making videos.
So kind of using cooking and testing the products. Correct. And then putting them in applications. So not much different. It's just there's not, you're not creating memories with weddings here, but you're putting that work into a product that other people can use to pursue.
Right. Mm-hmm. So maybe a lot of the backyard barbecue guys that would want to give me their opinions on my barbecue, I can now give them recipes on how to cook barbecue in their backyard.
Tell you what, I'll give you the fuel. Cook your own barbecue.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, I don't know. I look back at that and I'm just like, well, you're doing a percentage of what you love in a far less stressful, I would imagine, far less stressful environment. You know, that maybe
if I wore a dozen hats in my job running the restaurant, you know, marketing department was one of those hats. So just being able to fully concentrate on that is significantly less stressful. And also, you know, it's not breezing past it and on to the next task, but really just being able to adhere to the work ethic and standard that I like and produce, you know, with 100% of whatever it is I'm doing.
And I always laughed a little bit because I always thought that part of why you decided to barbecue, like to take on barbecue, was because you do like it outside, right? Like, for as long as I've known you, you've been, you know, a little outdoorsy. You know, you like to fish, all of that, and that somehow the best place for a chef who likes to do all that other stuff too is probably outside, standing next to a smoker, even if it's, you know, 2 below or 20 below, as it were. So this probably gives you a little bit more time for that as well. Hopefully,
A tremendous amount of time, actually.
So. That's great. I mean, if you saw the smile, like, I mean, you know, I think the folks give so much to the industry and so much time, that the free time, the idea of free time, I think, I don't know. I think nobody, I don't know anybody who has less free time than a chef in 90% of cases. So it's good to see you. Smiling.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
This was terrific to catch up and learn more about the ins and outs, the beginning and the ends of a restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, I'm not one to ever to never say never, but would you I didn't warn you that I would ask, but like, do you ever see yourself easing back into the industry? Or is that still not clear?
So. I'm not in any rush, but
so no, and like, I don't want to put that pressure on you because I think you deserve, you know, I mean, I don't know how many years, you know, is sufficient in rest, you know, for anybody who's worked an industry job for over 20 years. But you're certainly entitled to that.
Well, and famously, you only gain energy the older you get. Yeah. So
there you go. So.
Yeah. Well, whatever you do next, we know that it'll be awesome because we've seen your body of work. So
definitely. So
yes.
Well, no, thank you truly for coming and sharing. You know, we often get this view. You know, we often get the view of a place opening, but there's, I think, as much thinking that goes into a place closing, no matter the circumstances, almost. that there is. And I don't know. I think there's a lot to learn and a lot to glean from folks. So thank you for being willing to talk about it as well.
Absolutely.
Because that's definitely a journey.
What an outstanding conversation. Obviously not about the happiest of topics, you know, closing a restaurant, but it is nice to hear that it's their own terms. You know, you hear the horror stories out there about, you know, places get forced out or because business isn't there. And it sounds nice that, you know, if they're going to say goodbye, they got to do it on their, the way they wanted to.
Yeah. 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 And I have a lot of respect for, you know, his perspective and in terms of, you know, this was the right time to do this, you know, mm-hmm. It was based on circumstances to some extent that were not under his control. He didn't have, you know, he had lots of choices on ways to go and mm-hmm. this felt the best. And I think honestly, I mean, he's happy he landed in a good place and, from my perspective, that's, you know, that's what matters. And he got to see it, you know, I really think it's moving for somebody to get to see the impact they have.
Yeah. Cause there has always been, we talked about a little bit in there, that kind of idea of like pre-obituaries for like actors who, and it's just like, there's no really tasteful way to do it because you don't want to be like, hey, we think you're dying soon, so we're going to write. And we've talked about that, you know. Yeah. In a lot of cases, some of the articles that Rewrite and On Milwaukee are pieces where it's like, we don't know how much longer this place is going to be open, so we want to bring attention to it and to bring people to give it a shot. And, you know, even if it is still closing soon, so that way people can, you know, these people can read something that says, thank you for what you gave to our city and to our lives, instead of just, you know, fading out and feeling like all that hard work was for nothing, which is not true.
Right. No, absolutely. And it just goes to show, like, go to the places you love as much as you can, because mm-hmm. sometimes they will go away, not because they're failing or because something terrible and tragic happens, but because, you know, it's just time. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think this is just as good of a reminder as any, you know, to support the places while they're here. Because nothing lasts forever.
Yeah, nothing is certain. But what is certain is that you can find the Food Crush podcast on the internet. Seamless transition.
Yeah, for sure.
Lori, where can people find the Food Crush podcast?
Yeah, for sure. We found the podcast here. You can obviously listen on any platform of your choice. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by looking for Food Crush Pod. And where can people find you, Matt?
You can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find me nursing the finger that I cut the other night. It's healing really nicely, though. I'm showing Lori now on our Zoom screen. It's healed rather nicely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give me another week, and
Matt's
you'll never
done
even
enough
know
cooking.
That I.
He's done enough cooking where he's run into the.
It's finally happened. I finally maimed myself making a soup, which seems like a goofy way to hurt yourself. You don't think soup would be the most arduous, but you dice and chop up a bunch of stuff. And I was chopping some collard greens, and they became collard reds. But yeah, you can find me still in the kitchen cooking, but also at A Man About Film and on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Lori, where can people find you?
People can find me at Lo Frederick and all of those places. Twitter,
and
Facebook,
all of those places.
Instagram.
And of course, in case it wasn't obvious enough, you can also find us on onmilwaukee.com. That's where you can find our writing wares.
Yeah.
So
the word version.
Yes, the version.
The readable version of all of these things. So,
I mean, some people would argue I'm not readable, but that's fair. Lori, thanks. So we're still figuring out what we're going to do at the end of these episodes. You'll be the first ones to know when we come up with something. But in the meantime, we're just going to keep thanking our producers, thanking you for listening, thanking our wonderful guests, thanking my wonderful co-host, and thanking one more time, you wonderful listeners out there. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep cooking safely without chopping any of your fingers.
Please.
Please.